added this challenge. I just made it up actually late last night. I'm going to ask each of you to read through the Gospel of John twice this fall. I don't know how long it takes. Everyone reads at a different pace. We're not going to cover the whole gospel. That's why I'm going to ask you to do the whole thing, because my big concern is that in just preaching certain parts, we'll miss the rest. And this is a glorious book, and I don't want you to miss any of it. So there's my request. Read through it twice. Maybe take it, you know, once in September, October, once in November, December, and pick three verses and memorize them. There it is. There's that. And it's like memory. It's like, oh, we can't do that. You can. I believe in you wholeheartedly. Read twice. As you read through maybe the first time, you'll start to see a couple verses, two, three verses that you want to memorize. Memorize them. I am confident, this is your money back guarantee, that God will do good things in your life through that, because it's his word. It's not my guarantee, it's his. It's living, it's active, it's wonderful. There we go. Now you've got the whole package. Now we get to work. So like I said, we're going to spend, I think it ended up working out to like about 11 weeks in this gospel, looking at what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Because I don't know, maybe dating back, it's probably like 10, 15, maybe longer. I started to hear this kind of thing being said of the church, that what the church needs, like this is our pressing need, we need more and better leaders. And don't get me wrong, we always need godly, equipped, called, prayed for leaders. That will never change. But I remember I would hear that and there would be this little thought in the back of my head that would almost always follow that up with, you know, what if it's not so much a leader problem? What if what we really need is more encouraged, challenged followers? Like what if it's as much a follower problem? And then I look at myself in the mirror. It's like, you know, my greatest need is not someone so much to speak in as a leader. My greatest need is that I would follow Jesus well, because we already have the greatest leader ever. His name is Jesus, and he put his spirit within us. And then he simply says, follow me. Which if you're like me, you quickly understand that doesn't mean like literally like what it must have meant for the first disciples, where it's like, I'm going from this town to this town, and when I say follow me, I mean like I expect to turn around and see you, that there was something more to it. It was the sense of, I want you to be my disciples. I want you to understand that it is me through whom truth is going to come, and then I expect that you will believe that truth, and then as you see how I live to my Father's glory, that you would do the same thing. Like, man, if we had more and better followers, this world would be transformed. Okay, that's my simplistic understanding of things, which led to this series. What does that even look like? Because I could give you my impression. I could come up with lists of, here's what I think you ought to do if you want to be a disciple. But I thought, how much further ahead will we be if we let Jesus just speak? And so through the Gospel of John, we're going to take a look at 10, 11 spots where Jesus helps us understand what it means to follow. And we're going to start in John chapter 1. But I want to do one other thing this morning, and that is I want to give you a bit of a roadmap for the whole Gospel of John, so that as we go through it, you know how the pieces kind of fit. So if you've ever been around Emmanuel at the start of a series, you know that this is how I think. I just like to kind of understand the pieces and kind of how all the bits and pieces fit together. So I'm going to give you a bit of a roadmap. If this stuff just bores you, I'll give you a cue when it's time to kind of join back in, all right? Okay, so the book of John actually conveniently breaks down into four parts. They're not equal parts, so there's something that most people call the prologue that goes from 1:1 to 18, which maybe we might understand more like the introduction. And then at the end of the book, there's something called the epilogue, and you're not going to find those words in the book. These are just kind of the words we use to describe this. Basically, it's all of chapter 21. Don't mind my sloppy handwriting. You'll get the gist, right? So that's kind of the introduction and the conclusion. All the major themes and ideas in the whole book will be presented here. In fact, probably one of the most important things you could do is just look at the word usage. So this is really simple. You just look at sort of keywords, and if you were to read through the whole book and add them up, you're going to quickly understand that John has some really big ideas he wants to talk about. He wants to talk about life. He wants to talk about light. He's going to want to talk about the world and about truth and about belief. Now you're going, hold on a second. They're everywhere in the Bible. Like, why would you pick those? They are, in fact, everywhere all through the Bible, all through the other Gospels, in fact. But if you do the math, here's something very interesting that starts to happen. For example, let's just take this word life, for example. John uses that word 36 times in his Gospel. So then if you went to the other three Gospels and did the same thing, how many times does Matthew use it? Because he's telling the same gospel. There's not four gospels. There is one gospel according to Matthew and according to Mark and according to Luke and according to John. They're all talking about the same story. This is Jesus. This is what he did. This is who he is. Matthew uses that word 7 times. Mark uses it 4 times. John, 36 times. You get why this matters? Belief, all right? Matthew 11, Mark 18, John 98. You start to get the sense that John really, really wants us to get a few things. Light, John used it 23 times. The other Gospels combined 15, all together. You start to see that John, he thinks these things are really important for us as we're going to read through the gospel. So notice that kind of stuff. So we've got the prologue, and we've got the epilogue. Come back to that in a second. And then in between, we have the other two parts, which are the big parts of the book that often are referred to as the book of signs, because through this section, you get all the miracles in the Gospel of John that goes from 1:19 to the end of chapter 12, which is 51, if anyone's looking. I think it's 51. And then the second part is the book of glory, which goes from 13:1 to 31. Can you read that at the back? Perfect. All right, so there's our outline. Let's unpack this just for a second, and then we're going to jump into kind of just after this part mainly, as we see the first scene of what it looks like to follow Jesus Christ. Okay, this part here is worth becoming really, really familiar with. So when you're reading through the Gospel of John, read very slowly. Pay attention to what's going on in these 18 verses, because everything that's going to come after will be introduced right there. Really, really important stuff. So, for example, this whole second section is all about what it looks like when Jesus does miraculous things that are referred to as signs, which is interesting, right? In the other Gospels, sign is always a bad thing. You notice that? The other Gospels, when people are asking for a sign, Jesus often will refer to them as like, well, a wicked generation asks for a sign. But in John, it's a good thing. He does 7 signs because they point to who he is. And the whole point is that he's going to show himself through these things so that people believe. But what do we find out in chapter 1, verse 11? Here's what John tells us. In the introduction, he came to his own, but his own people did not receive him. In other words, as he does this through this first section of the book, as he shows himself, there are going to be a whole lot of people who reject that. Right? So it doesn't surprise us when we get to the end of this section, here in chapter 12. What do we read? Here's the summary of this part of the book. I'm just going to pick up verse 37. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. You get what John's doing? He's saying, I'm going to just alert you to the fact that there's going to be a whole lot of people. They're going to see everything he does, and they won't believe. Then he shows us that, and then he summarizes it and says, there, I showed you that. But then what happens next in John chapter 1, verse 12? We find out that there's another group who will believe. So we're told in verse 12, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. So what do we expect this to be about? See, we're sharp today, right? It's going to be about people who did believe. It's going to be about the disciples who saw it and said, he is the Messiah. And we find that's exactly what's going to happen through those chapters. Jesus begins to reveal himself. He speaks. A lot of it's one of his big farewell speeches, so to speak. But we read in chapter 13, verse 1, the start of that whole thing. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew his hour had come to depart out of the world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. You hear that? He loved his own. It's exactly what John's talking about back in chapter 1, verse 12. So, all that to say, pay a lot of attention. This will help us as we walk through this middle part of the book, because we're going to see John just opens up these verses so that we see who Jesus is. How are we going to do for time? We ran out of time badly in the first service, so I'm trying to figure out how we can speed things up. So I'll talk a little bit quicker. Jesus in the temple. Oh, just kidding. I won't do that. I will pick and choose just a little bit. I do want to just point out this couple other things in the prologue so we don't miss them, because I'm not going to come back and preach this section. Look at verse 14 for a second. We read this, and the Word became flesh, so this is a description of Jesus, and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. That becomes a huge part of what John wants us to see. He wants these first disciples to see it, and then he wants for all time for people to see this. Now, if you've got a translation that says something like, the Word became flesh and lived for a little while among us, you have my permission, and I know some people hate when I do this. It's like, just clarify that it's he dwelt. John's not making the point that this is a temporary thing, in other words. Right? There are some translations that say he lived for a little while among us. Like, Jesus came, pitched his tent, then he took it down and he left. That's not John's point. What's so amazing to John is that Jesus came and dwelt, and he's never leaving. That's John's point. And he looks back to this scene in Exodus when God first dwelt, because that's what he's borrowing on way back in Exodus 24, when God first came and his glory came, and it's this amazing moment, but it left. But John says, oh, but now I'm going to introduce you to the one who is the glory of God. Right? When you understand that part and then read the rest of the gospel, it starts to make sense why John tells the stories that he picks. Right? All four gospels tell a story of Jesus cleansing the temple. Right? They all record that story. It's just Matthew, Mark, and Luke all put that story right at the end of the story. So you get through the whole thing, and then there's this story right at the end. You want to know what? John tells the same story, but he puts it in chapter 2. Isn't that interesting? It's not because he's confused or trying to lie to us. He's just trying to say, there's a scene in the life of Jesus that's so important. I want you to know it right out of the gate. And what is the scene? Jesus goes into the temple. He sees what's going on. It's not good. He cleanses the temple. And then he starts saying some odd-sounding things, essentially like this. I am the temple. That's what he's announcing. If you destroy it, he says to them, I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And they go, hold on a second, that's impossible. It took us all these years to do it. You can't possibly do that. And we find out through sort of the words of the writers of the gospel, he's talking about himself. In other words, he's saying, I am the glory. It's not a building. And John says in chapter 1, verse 14, here's the point. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Do you realize how privileged you are this morning? I don't think we even can begin to scratch the surface. I just don't think we truly fathom it. If you go back to Exodus 33, Moses there is the description of his relationship with God. He's a man who's a friend of God. He speaks with God face to face. And if you read, you know, Moses in the story there in Exodus 33, you think, oh man, what an amazing thing that must have been. Moses on Mount Sinai with God and this intimacy there. But you know, as you read through Exodus chapter 33, the one thing Moses wants to see is the glory of God. It's what he asks God. And God basically says, you know what, Moses? You can't. That's the one thing I'm going to withhold from you. But to hear what John announces right there in chapter 1, verse 14, we have seen his glory. In other words, the thing that's withheld from Moses is not withheld from you. Not if you see Jesus. And we need to pray that our ears just, like don't make me so deaf to this, Lord. Like, help me understand how amazing. In other words, Moses would trade places with me to see the glory of Christ that I've been privileged to see. That's what John's announcing. Now, what is the glory of Christ according to the book of John? The glory of Christ is his death on a cross. We'll look at that as the book unfolds, but you see it in chapter 12, verse 23, 31, 32, 33, where essentially John is going to make a point and help us understand that the more God stoops, the more there is suffering, the greater the glory of God. The pinnacle moment for John as he writes his gospel is not the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, he records a scene at the foot of the cross in John chapter 19, I think it's verse 26. He records that he's there, he's the only gospel writer who does it, the apostle Jesus loved is there, and then right after that he says, I bore witness to this, now we believe. You know what's interesting about that? Jesus hasn't risen yet. You think about that for a second. Why would John put that right there instead of after the resurrection? It's because he looks and he knows there's the glory of God on a cross, crowned with thorns. On a cross, instead of a throne, but he's the king, the glory of God at that moment. That's going to become important because by the time we get to the end of the book, we're going to see that we're called to glorify God in the exact same way. Not to atone for sin, but to glorify him as we stoop. All right, so that's the introduction. The book of signs, this little part right here, built around seven miracles that are called signs that all reveal something more of Jesus. And actually, John's really helpful. He numbers them for us. So the first one comes in chapter 2, the water to wine. That's the first, which is actually interesting. It's the seventh day of the whole story, which probably corresponds to creation, for those of you who are looking for an interesting thing to think about. The second one comes in chapter 4, verse 54, and John is super helpful. He actually goes, and this is the second sign, just so you don't miss it, right? He's actually numbering them. The next one comes in chapter 6, I think verse 14, right after Jesus turns, he feeds the multitude is what he does, and the people go, this is the prophet. It's capitalized usually because they're referring to something back in Deuteronomy 18, which we will get to this morning. You know, they see the sign, they conclude, this is the prophet. They're making a great statement about Jesus. But you see kind of how that works, right? They see Jesus feed them in the wilderness in a miraculous way, and they go, hold on a second. We remember this. That's how the miracle functions. There was a miracle way, way, way back in Moses' day when they were in the wilderness, and Moses was able to feed them, and God worked in a miraculous way. And then he told us about a prophet who was to come, who we ought to listen to. And they go, Jesus, you must be the one. See, that's how the miracle works. It helps them understand who Jesus is. It brings light to the picture. But by the time we get to the last miracle, which is the final sign, it's Lazarus being raised from the dead, right? Which prepares us completely for what's to come in this part, which is Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. You see how Lazarus, it's a sign. Yes, it's truly a miracle, but it was a sign that pointed to something even greater, because here's the problem. Lazarus did rise from the dead, but he's going to die again. In fact, there's even a plot where they decide they want to kill him. But it points to something even greater, that Jesus will rise from the dead, and he will not die. It's eternal now. So all these signs point in that sort of direction. Okay, last but not least, this part here really has to do with building to the glory of Jesus, which is his victory on the cross. And I hope that's how you read the story of Jesus going to the cross. That when you get to Good Friday, yeah, there's a strange part of that where we understand that he's there because of our sin, but don't ever lose sight that he's winning. That's triumph. That's the glory of God right at that moment. In fact, if you look through that section, right here in chapter 20, verse 31, is the actual purpose statement of John. He actually gives us his purpose. I wrote these things so that you would believe. But don't miss the scene right before it. Right, because if you're writing a paper and getting to your conclusion statement, probably what you put right before that would not be very, very important? It's like the last, I'm going to really make sure I've pounded this thing home before I make my concluding statement. What does John talk about right before that? He tells us a story of one of the disciples. One of the disciples who doubted Jesus. His name was Thomas. And he was the one that said, you know what, unless I actually could put my finger in the hole, I'm not believing. And then we get this little description. Jesus shows up. He actually says to Thomas, put your finger here. Okay. Now this is, you don't have to say it out loud, but some of you know this one. What does Thomas say in response to all that? He says, my Lord and my God. It's the whole point of the book. And then, having shown that example, John says, I wrote this whole thing so that we could have time after time after time, hundreds and thousands and millions of times where people read the story of Jesus and get to the end, and here's their conclusion. He is my Lord and my God. You see, at the start, it is a massive start. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. It's a massive sort of vision of Jesus. But you see the piece that's missing from that at the start? My Lord, my God. He never wasn't God. But John's asking this question, is he yours? And so Thomas is our first example of someone who gets it. And then John says, that's why I wrote the book. Right there. Okay, that's the Book of Glory. The epilogue just tells us that we as readers who come to believe in Jesus are now supposed to go out and teach this. It's really, really plain for Peter, who point blank is told, Peter, feed my sheep 3 times, in case you're a slow learner, Peter, which he seems to be. Feed my sheep, feed my sheep, feed my sheep. But that's not just a Peter thing. You notice John picks it up because he writes the gospel. John's there and he's listening to this whole thing. The light bulb goes on. It's not just Peter. We're all supposed to, the second I come to believe that Jesus is my Lord, my God, I'm supposed to go and proclaim this and make sure others know who he is. Right? That's the ending. And then the last part that maybe we don't love, but it's really important to see, is that it happens, we glorify God in suffering. That's John 21, verse 19, where Jesus says, hey, Peter, by the way, you're going to suffer for this. But it's not like I'm punishing you, Peter. It's not that. It's because, Peter, God is going to be glorified most, just like he was in me on the cross. And Peter, just as I stooped further and further and the glory shone brighter and brighter, Peter, when you go further and further, glory of God's going to shine. And the book ends. Okay, let's make sure we understand the first chapter. That's our goal this morning. We got 15 minutes-ish to do it. So I'm going to just really quickly go through the first few verses, point out a couple things so that we can get to the disciple part here, beginning about verse 29. Yep, I'll do it. Okay, so just a couple quick things. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we read that and we go, John's talking about creation. He will in verse 3, but I just want to point this out just so you understand how massive a vision that John has of Jesus Christ. He's not talking about creation in verse 1. Yes, Jesus was there at creation, but you see what John's doing? He's saying, it's way bigger than that. Now, we are bound by time and space, and God isn't, so God is eternal, so there is no beginning with God, but he puts it in words that help us understand how huge this is. In the beginning was the Word. In the absolute beginning, the beginning before the in the beginning of Genesis 1, where God creates the heavens and the earth, Jesus was there at the absolute beginning of the beginning of the beginning, because he is the eternal God. He's always been there. This is John's point. And yes, he was there in verse 3 when all things were made because it was made through him. But don't just limit your view to this point of creation that, oh, Jesus was there at the point of creation. No, John says, it's way bigger than that. He's never not been there, is what John wants you to see right out of the gate. And if you kind of get that sense in mind as you read through the book, you'll start to see how incredible a view of Jesus the Apostle John has. There is nothing small in any of it. Look at verse 16 as an example. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. There's multiple ways to interpret that interesting little statement, the grace upon grace. And it's again, we're going to be stuck a little bit for time, but One way is just to say, you know, we just get increasing amounts of grace. So you get a little bit of grace, and then more grace, and more grace, and more grace. That's one view. The other is that we get the grace that belongs to Jesus. In other words, Jesus has grace and then gives it to us. But it's actually the third, the most logical sense of the words goes something like this. That in the Old Testament, through the law, grace was given. You see that. It's actually spelled right out in the passage. That grace was given through the law. And then John's saying, I'm not ignoring that there was grace given through the law. I just want to point out that the grace that comes through Jesus is the fullness of grace. Like, if you actually want to understand, define grace, just put a picture of Jesus. Because that's who he is. He is the embodiment of grace and truth. You see how John's just like, just this view of Jesus that just gets massive. And he wants you to know how amazing, how spectacular Jesus Christ is at every turn. Now, let's pick up in verse 19 and quickly move ourselves along here. John the Baptist has been testifying about Jesus. He's the one he's baptizing. Somewhere along the line, word gets back to the religious leaders. We're going to come back to John the Baptist next week, by the way. They send out some representatives to John the Baptist with a question. The question is, who are you? And I don't know how they asked it. I don't know if it was like, who do you think you are? Or honestly inquiring, we don't really know. But he answers, and his answer is, I am not the Christ. Which I contend is a very odd way to respond to that question. If someone came to you and said, who are you? And you started saying, well, you know, I'm not this guy, and I'm not that guy, and, you know, the guy you saw down at Home Depot, I'm not him either. You see why this is an odd answer? And then they start asking him other questions. What then? Are you Elijah? I'm not. Are you the prophet? No. Now, in our ears, it sounds like they're asking about three different individuals. That's not what's going on in the passage. All those terms are terms that the Jews associated with the Messiah. It's almost like they're trying to trick him. It's like, okay, you're not the Christ. Are you the prophet? They're asking the same question. Nope. I told you the first time. I'm not him. And the way he answers the question, the force of it is, no, but there is another. In fact, he says exactly that in chapter 3. I am not the Christ. I've been telling you all along. I just came before him. In other words, there is, and he is right here. In fact, that's what John's going to tell us next. They say in verse 22, well, who are you? We've got to go back, and we were sent with one little question to find out who you are. We've got to go give an answer. John, what do you have to say about yourself? And here's what he says. I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Make straight the way of the Lord. There's a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 40 that speaks of preparing the way for Yahweh, God. And John uses it and says, here's my job. I'm preparing the way for God. Oh, and by the way, I'm not even fit to take off his sandals. We're going, okay, John, you've done something odd there. You've talked about preparing the way for God, but John, do you honestly think God comes and wears sandals? And if you see that sort of stuff as John begins to speak, you're going to understand what he's trying to wrestle through. As it almost seems to begin to dawn on him that something spectacular is happening. God's coming, but it's almost like as John begins to think of it, he's like, that can't be possible, can it? No, it must be a man. And we have the advantage of knowing it's the God-man. But John doesn't. He's preparing the way for God, but he's wearing sandals. Wouldn't it be interesting to be able to say to John, what did you think? Like, what did you really expect right then? I'm not sure how he would even answer. But that's his answer. Who are you? I'm just here to prepare the way. A few verses later, in fact, it's the next day, he saw Jesus coming towards him, and here's what he says of Jesus. Behold, the Lamb of God who comes to take away the sins of the world. Massive statement. Make sure you think that one through. John's saying, this man who just walked onto the scene is going to actually be able to deal with the problem of sin. That none of us can on our own, but he can. He's going to take it away. Now, his disciples hear this. A few verses later, we find out that John, in verse 35, is standing there with two of his disciples, so he's had some people following him. They hear John say this, behold the Lamb of God, and they follow Jesus. They get it right. John has done a brilliant job of preparing these disciples to have their full loyalty and allegiance shift from him to Jesus. And that's exactly what we read in this passage. And everything that takes place from here to the end of the chapter is these disciples, people just like us, trying to figure out who Jesus is. All right, so let's quickly see how they do it. So we got our first two there in verse 35. Jesus turns to them and he asks them a great question. What are you looking for? I mean, that would be an interesting question if you were one of the disciples of John. It's like, now we're following you. And Jesus just turned and said, what are you looking for? It's like, I don't know what went through their minds. I know what came out of their mouths because it's recorded for us. Where are you staying? I mean, you see the sort of some of the humor in some of this, right? It's like you've got the Messiah standing before, and the question that comes out of your mouth is, where do you live? Like, if somehow that's important. And Jesus, in his mercy, doesn't say what I would have said, which I won't tell you. Instead, he says, come and you will see, which I think is like so many other statements in the Gospel of John, where there is way more meaning packed into that than we could ever realize. It's like the woman at the well who asked Jesus for water, and Jesus starts talking about another type of water. And she's got to figure out in her head, it's like, oh, we're not talking about water in a cup. We're talking about, it's like the people who come to Jesus for bread, and he starts talking about himself as the bread of life. Right? All through the book of John, we see this going on where they say, it's like Nicodemus coming to Jesus, and Jesus talks about being born again. And all that goes through Nicodemus's head is, that can't be possible. You couldn't, that just, it wouldn't fit the logistics, and he doesn't even clue in that Jesus is talking about a spiritual reality. It's like in John chapter 9 where Jesus heals a man of blindness and then starts talking about spiritual blindness, and that the Pharisees is just going over their heads because they're not following. And here in John chapter 1, we have these disciples hearing from Jesus, come, follow me, and you will see. Man, you know how important that is? Because that's exactly what's going to happen. It's not just about come follow me and you'll see where I'm staying. It's come and follow me and I'm going to change your lives. That's what it means to be a follower of Jesus. If you're going to sign on and say, I will make him my Lord and my God, be prepared for your life to be changed. You want evidence of it? Just look when Peter meets him. A few verses later, Andrew's there. He's introduced to Jesus. He understands that Jesus is the Messiah. The first thing he does is he invites his brother along. Peter, you got to come see what I found. I found the Messiah. Peter shows up and Jesus looks at him and says, I'm going to change your name. He doesn't even say it. He doesn't ask permission. He just says, oh, hey, by the way, now from now on, your name is Peter. Can you imagine if someone came up to you this on the way out, if someone met you in the foyer and said, hey, I'm no longer going to call you Don. From now on, I'm going to call you Jim. Perfectly good name, but I'd be like, I think what would be going through my head, I probably wouldn't say it, is who do you think you are? Like, you don't just get to do that. But you see that Jesus does. He claims absolute authority over the lives of his followers, and he will change everything for them. It's a bit ironic, isn't it, that he chooses rock? It's like Peter. You'll be the rock. Isn't that like an image of stability and solid? And then we know Peter. One moment it's spectacular, and the next moment a train wreck, the whole way through the story. But Jesus says, Peter, I'm not done. And right in the end, you see, of course, what happens in the end of the book. God transforms this man. He becomes exactly what God tells him he will be. Isn't that so good? Because you see, your life and my life are as good as we know how to make them. Like, if your life's a bit of a train wreck and you're going, it's a bit of a mess, you have done as good as you can do. It's a humbling thing, isn't it? That's as good as you can do. And if you're like me, it's like, I want more than that, then you need Jesus. And he can transform us. It's incredible news. It's what he's doing with these disciples. He comes to the next one, Philip, and he says, follow me. It's the first, actually, disciple that Jesus commands to follow him. Philip then goes away and he has a conversation with Nathanael, and he tells, we found Jesus of Nazareth. You should come and check him out. And Nathanael's response is, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And Philip has no, you would think Philip would be, I don't know, what would you say? If you just think you found the Messiah and you go to a friend and their response is, nothing good comes from that town, wouldn't you want to start trying to explain who he is and what you found and some of the Instead, he says, come and see. Which is so good, because that's actually what Philip does his whole life. He just asks and points out the oddest things through the whole book of John. You know, he's the one actually, a little bit later in the story, some Greek men come to Jesus. They want to see him. They come to Philip. Can we see Jesus? And Philip can't. He doesn't know what to say. It's the disciples like, can we see Jesus? He's got to go get Andrew because he doesn't know how to answer the question. It's all through this story of Philip. He's the one that when in the feeding of the 5,000, Philip's there and Jesus says, Philip, how are we going to feed all these people? Here's Philip's answer. I kid you not. Even if we had 200 denarii, we couldn't buy enough bread that everyone could even have a taste. Isn't that a great answer? I just can't imagine. Who imagines that is the answer? Okay, this is my best answer, Jesus. Even if we had this imaginary amount of money, we couldn't buy this imaginary amount of bread to even give this people a taste. Like, my imagination's a little better. It's like I could imagine enough bread that everyone could get a taste. Jesus, it would take 1,000 denarii to feed all these people, but not Philip. He's like, even if we had 200, we couldn't. It's like, Philip, like, this is who he is the whole way through the story. Every time you see Philip, those are the kind of answers. And I read that, and you think I'm making fun of him. I'm just feeling like I'm in good company because I'm him. Ever noticed, you know, someone asks you a question and you give an answer and then later, I'm the guy going, if I had just said this, it would have made so much sense. And yet Jesus calls the Philips and the Andrews and the Peters and the people just like us and says, it's not about the greatness of the disciple. It's about the greatness of the God who calls them and works in them. Do not ever, ever think you're disqualified because you're an ordinary, average person, because your God is not. We see this all through the lives of these men. The last scene, and this is where we need to land the plane this morning, is this last man named Nathanael, who we're not even sure if he's actually one of the 12 disciples. He really doesn't show up much except for one last mention in chapter 21. But bear with me for just a couple more minutes, and then we'll turn you loose on s'mores on a stick. Because I think what we normally do with chapter 1 is we think we've got the important bits, and then we drop Nathanael's story, particularly the end part, because it seems odd. Can anything good come from Nazareth? And Jesus comes along, and here's what he says to him. Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit. Now let me just translate that ever so slightly for you to help you see what Jesus has just done. Behold, an Israelite. There's no deceit. There's no Jacob in this guy. So he's just said, an Israelite in whom there's no Jacob. See, Jesus has gone back to Genesis chapter 27. Read the story, Genesis 27, 28 sometime. You'll see exactly what Jesus is doing in these last few verses. He comes to Nathanael and says, Nathanael, I need you to remember a story. There was a man once in the history of the nation of Israel who becomes the father, essentially, of this nation, who was known as a deceitful man. If you brought up the names, like, Jacob, tell us about Jacob. He's a liar. It's just who he is every time. And God says, Jacob, I'm going to change you. You will be different. And he gives him a new name. He transforms this man around a story where he has a vision in the middle of the night, a dream, that we might know as the story of Jacob's ladder. 48, Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? See, Nathanael's starting to recognize something's going on here. And Jesus said, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Now, we don't know what the situation was, what the scene was. Evidently, it was a scene where no one could have known or seen Nathanael, and except Jesus is aware of this and says to Nathanael, I was there. Not physically, but Nathanael, I know everything. That's essentially what he's saying. Now, look at Nathanael's response to that revelation. Rabbi, teacher, you are. We have to wrestle through that a little bit because it means probably a little less than it sounds like at first. He's referring to Psalm 2. I don't think Nathanael has fully grasped that Jesus is God. But he's saying some massive things about who Jesus is. But don't stop the story yet. Jesus answered him, because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? In other words, Nathanael does believe, but Jesus is just pointing out, here's the reason. It's because of what I was able to do, this miraculous, greater things than these. And he said to him, and make sure you get verse 51. Here's where it all ends. Truly, truly. That's Jesus' way of saying, mark this. This matters. I say to you, you will see heaven open, the angels of God descending and ascending on the Son of Man. That Son of Man is just how Jesus refers to himself. I mean, why is that such a big deal? It's because he's just told us that Jesus has in mind Genesis 28, where Jacob has a vision. And in his vision, he sleeps, and there's a stairway, and God's at the top, and angels are going. God was in this place. In fact, he says, it is an awesome thing. God was right here. He renames the place Bethel, the house of God. God was here. And Jesus comes in verse 51 and says to this group of disciples, he says, I want you to understand truly who I am. There's no stairway, there's no ladder anymore. I'm it. You want access to heaven? You want to know the Father? I'm it. And beyond that, Nathanael and Philip and Andrew and Peter and Emmanuel, you want to know what you need to know about Jesus Christ, the one who we follow? God. That's who he is. He's just revealed it for the first time in chapter 1, verse 51. I am God. This is an awesome thing, disciples, because the one who stands before you is none other than God himself. That's what it's going to look like to follow Jesus. It will change your life. It amazes us to think that he, the Son of God, would walk among us and be with us and dwell with us and be for us and die in our place and invite us to follow him. And Father, help us to know more and more of what that means. We want to honor you by how we live. And so we thank you that we can worship Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, my God and my Lord. Amen.